We're still on handout 8. Just briefly by review, where we are in the outline is we've worked ourselves up through the persecution, the Antiochian persecution we covered, I guess, maybe a couple weeks ago. And we're pausing now and taking a quick look at two topics that were happening throughout this period, one of which was Hellenization, which we talked about in detail last week. We remember we talked about the three responses to Hellenization among the Jews, which were sort of acceptance of it, embracing it, and then the other side of the spectrum was strong resistance, and then the middle path was what I called synthesis, trying to synthesize the Greek way of thinking and Hellenistic ideas with the Jewish religion. And so those were the three responses that we talked about last week. This week, we're going to take a step back and look at what was happening with the high priesthood throughout this time. Both of these things, well, I guess all three of them, Hellenization in general, of course the persecution itself was a key catalyst, but we've got the persecution, Hellenization in general, and then what was happening with the priesthood. All three of those things kind of are setting us up for the revolt that happened in the Maccabean revolt. So that's kind of where we're headed, and we'll probably get to that next time. So today we'll take a look at what was happening with the priesthood. So when the Jews went into exile in Babylon, the temple was destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed the temple in Jerusalem. And many of the people were taken into exile, and certainly the important people were taken into exile. So the priestly line had pretty much been deported, and probably some were executed during the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, but many were deported into Babylon and taken off into Babylon. And so there's no temple anymore, so the priestly ministry had basically ceased during the exile. There was still a priestly line, which we know from what happened after the return from exile, but the priestly ministry seems to have basically ceased during the exile. That makes sense because there was no temple for the priest to minister in. So after the return from exile, we pick up again, the priestly line picks up again. The temple was rebuilt, and there were priests ministering in the temple. So what we're going to do is kind of go through the list of the priests up to the end of this period. The main source for the list of the priests is, again, Josephus, and I'll be referring to his list here in a moment. Just so you're clear, that's the main source. And while we can piece together the succession of the priests throughout this period, there's very few details, just like I mentioned earlier, there's very few details of what was happening in Palestine during this time. And there's very few details about the religious situation, I would say, among the population. There was probably a mix of things going on. Some people were interested in adopting and embracing the Greek ideas that had come in, and then there were probably other people who were more standing firm in the traditional religion, the Jewish religion. So just keep in mind that the details are a little bit sketchy here. So the post-exilic, I think I've got this into kind of three sections here. On the outline, it's number 2, number 3, and number 4. So we'll start with the post-exilic biblical priestly record. So after the return from exile, we know who the priests were because the Bible tells us. So we've got a list of those who returned and sort of the succession there. So first off, we start with Jeshua. And you remember Jeshua, that was the priest who returned from exile with Zerubbabel and was closely associated with him. You often see their names together in Ezra and Nehemiah. You often see Zerubbabel and Jeshua's names tightly linked together. Jeshua was the son of Jozadak, and we're told this in Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, that's important because Jozadak is a descendant of Zadok. So you remember when we talked about the persecution that Onias III, the final priest who was deposed by Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, was from the line of Zadok. And so that line had been carried on, and we mentioned, for 800 years. And so we know that the priest that returned from exile with Zerubbabel was from the Zadokite line that had gone into exile. So the line of Zadok pretty much picked up again after the return from exile. So he had a son by the name of Joiakim. He's mentioned in Nehemiah as well, and he was the priest during Ezra and Nehemiah's time. So remember, that was some years later, after they had rebuilt the temple, Ezra and Nehemiah returned. There was a long period of time between the return and the arrival of Ezra, possibly like around 70 years. So it's possible that there were other priests in between Joshua and Joiakim. In other words, it's possible that this is a collapsed genealogy like we have in Scripture at times, but it's not really necessary. It is important to remember, though, when you're looking at genealogies, that it's not always a literal son-father relationship. Sometimes we have compressed genealogies where there are other people in between that aren't mentioned. So that's a possibility here, but it's not completely necessary. This is discussed in some of the commentaries on Ezra and Nehemiah. That brings us to Eliashib, who was a son of Joiakim. So he's referred to in Nehemiah. He's called the high priest, and he worked on the rebuilding during the time of Nehemiah. So under Nehemiah, he was one of the people that's mentioned as having rebuilt part of the walls. So he's also called a high priest. It's possible here that Joiakim was the priest when Ezra arrived in Jerusalem, and that by the time Nehemiah arrived a few years later, Eliashib was the high priest. And you remember the situation when Nehemiah returned. We talked about that way back many, many weeks ago during the Old Testament background of the problems that Nehemiah found when he arrived. The corruption of the high priesthood was one of them. Remember that they had brought foreigners into the temple, which was something that was forbidden by the law. You also remember the violation of the intermarriage problems. So that was dealt with by Ezra, first of all. And then when Nehemiah returned many years later, he faced the same problem. So the intermarriage with the other pagan nations around them continued to creep back in. Those two laws are important because we see in Nehemiah what happened. Eliashib, we learn from Nehemiah chapter 13, it says that he was related to Tobiah the Ammonite. We don't know exactly how he was related. It's possible that he married a daughter of Tobiah the Ammonite. So Tobiah the Ammonite in Nehemiah was one of the enemies of Israel. And Eliashib had actually provided him a room in the temple, if you remember the story. When Nehemiah came back, he had to go into the room and threw out all of his furniture. But this was a serious violation of the temple laws. So a foreigner had been given a room in the temple, and not only was he a foreigner, but he was someone who had been opposing the Jews during the time of Nehemiah. Then we come to Joiada, who was a son of Eliashib. This is also still in Nehemiah now. Now, one of his sons had married into the family of Sanballat the Horonite. You remember him. He was another enemy of Israel, of Nehemiah at the time. So we've got one of the priests giving a room in the temple to an Ammonite. Then we have his son marrying into the family of the Horonite, Sanballat. And Nehemiah had to deal with both of these problems when he returned to Jerusalem. And you remember what he says at the end of Nehemiah chapter 13. He writes this, that these folks had desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. And so remember, that's kind of how the Old Testament ends, with this picture of continuing falling back into corruption of the priesthood, keeping of the Sabbath day and things like that, which is what we covered earlier. And these priests here that are mentioned in the Old Testament were really part of the cause of that, Eliashib and Joiada. Now, Joiada had a son by the name of Jonathan, and we learn this from Nehemiah chapter 12. It gets a little confusing here. The succession here is unclear. I'll just briefly walk you through this. So now it might be good to turn to your figure 8. There's some confusion here. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on. So I've given kind of two options. There's really like 4 there, but there's 2 options. The one on the left is option 1. The one on the right is option 2. Option 1, you can see there's a 1a and a 1b from Nehemiah chapter 12, verse 10 and 12, verse 22. If you read these two sections, you'll see that succession line there, you know, coming down, the one on the left and then the one just beside it there on the right. You'll notice that there's a name that's different. The third one down there, Jonathan, which is who we're speaking of, versus Johanan. The reason it's unclear is because there's a son of Eliashib named Johanan who may be the same as this Jonathan. Johanan is listed as a son of Eliashib at the time of Ezra. But alternatively, this guy Johanan could be a brother of Jehoiada, in which case it's very unclear. So that version of it is over on the right in option 2, where Johanan is not actually a son of Jehoiada, but he's a brother of Jehoiada. So you can see the two options there. It's kind of, you know, technical discussion to get into, but if Jonathan and Johanan are the same person, then you would have the version on the left, and it's basically describing the same lineage, just using 2 different names. If they're not the same person, you come over to option 2 there, and you can see I've got some bullet points there on what the takeaway is there. There's a couple different options. Derek Kidner is a commentator who has written about this in some detail and kind of tried to figure this out also. He prefers option 2B there on the right. I'm not persuaded that that's the right option. I think it's more likely option 2A, but it doesn't really matter that much. Just to note that if you're reading that, you may see, like in Nehemiah, it's pretty obvious. If you're reading chapter 12, just 12 verses apart, you'll see a different name there. And so you can refer to this table if you want to go in and look at that in more detail. I mentioned before that there were some documents that were found in Egypt during the First World War called the Elephantine Papyri. Oh, no, that's not the same thing. That's the Letters of Zenon. I'm sorry, so strike that. That wasn't the ones that were found during World War I. But the Elephantine Papyri are another group of documents that were found. And they do mention a high priest by the name of Johanan during the reign of Darius II, which fits right into this time frame. So we have confirmation of the biblical record in the Elephantine Papyri. Anyways, that brings us to the last guy on the list there. At the bottom, all the way across, the guy on the bottom there is Jaddua. And he's a son of Jonathan, and he's the last priest that's mentioned in the Old Testament. And so he's mentioned in Nehemiah and last one mentioned in the Old Testament. So Josephus also refers to a Jaddua, and we're not quite sure if this is the same person or not, which we'll talk about here in a minute. So that brings us to the end of what we know from the Bible. After that, we have to pretty much pick up. Now we're into the so-called period of silence, and so we'll pick up the line from Josephus. Now, this one also has some complications in it, but now you can flip your handout over there. And I've tried to put in a table here what Josephus' record looks like. So I've given you the line there, the reference in Josephus' Antiquities, and then the ruler that was ruling at the time, along with the date. So the first person that Josephus mentions at this point is Eliashib. It's probably likely that he intends this to be the biblical Eliashib of Nehemiah's day, which is, you know, the guy we were just talking about on the previous table. However, we know from what we talked about before with Josephus that he confuses the chronology of Ezra and Nehemiah and the Persian rulers. Remember, because of Ezra's digression, again, that's a long time ago, we talked about that, you might not remember, but he confused the chronology there like a lot of people do even today in that section of Ezra. But it's probably likely that he assumes that this is the same Eliashib. And then he lists the next man by the name of Judas, who was a son of Eliashib, who has succeeded him at his death. And if he's giving the same record as the Bible, that Judas would correspond to Jehoiada on the other table. John is the next one, a son of Judas, who succeeded him at his death. Remember, the priesthood at this point in time was a lifelong priesthood. So you were high priest until you died or until you handed it over to your son, maybe once you were unable to fulfill the office anymore. But it was a lifelong priesthood. So most of the priests died and then their sons took over. So this John, if Josephus is trying to follow the biblical account here, this would be the same as the Jonathan or Johanan on the other table. This is the first one we have a record of a ruler, Artaxerxes, that Josephus talks about. He doesn't mention which Artaxerxes. And there's several, as you remember. But it's probably on the table there. You can see it's probably Artaxerxes II. Now this John, Josephus records an incident where his brother Jesus, which is the Greek name, of course, for Joshua, he challenged him for the priesthood, and there was actually a battle, and John ended up killing his brother because he was trying to take over the priesthood. Josephus records that story. Now, after this, we have Jaddua, and again, this lines up with the biblical record. Now, Josephus places Jaddua during the time of the last Persian ruler, Darius III. So that also then places him during the conquest of Alexander the Great. So this is the priest. You remember we talked about the story of how Alexander came to Jerusalem and was met by the high priest, the contingent of the priests coming outside the city to meet him. This is the priest who, according to Josephus, was the one who did that. So this is Jaddua, the priest that met Alexander the Great. Now, he also tells a story, Josephus that is, also tells a story of a brother of Jaddua named Manasseh, who was also a priest. Now, this Manasseh married a daughter. Again, here's the intermarriage thing happening again. A daughter of a Samaritan, Sanballat. That name Sanballat recurs over and over again also. So you remember that word from the Bible, but it also shows up in subsequent generations, which would be the case here. Well, the story is that because Manasseh had married outside of the Jewish family, so again, now he's a high priest and he's marrying a non-Israelite. So he was forced out of the priesthood because of this marriage. But his father-in-law, Sanballat, said, "No problem, I'll build you another temple, and you can be the high priest there." So this, according to Josephus, is the origin of the temple that was built on Mount Gerizim, which is really the establishment of the Samaritan sect. So that's something to note from the New Testament, particularly when you think about the woman at the well. And she was talking about, you know, we worship on this mountain. This is the origin of that worship that they would have been carrying on there in Samaria. Okay? So this is sort of an important thing that impacts what we read in the New Testament. Once again, there's chronological problems here. There's confusion in Josephus' account of the biblical record. The question that scholars are wrestling with is whether this Jaddua that Josephus is talking about is the same Jaddua as what we have as the last priest mentioned in the Old Testament. I'll just skip all the details here, but it seems probable that this Jaddua is a later figure than the Jaddua that's mentioned in the Bible. So I don't think we should equate those two folks, because I think because of the chronology, this Jaddua is probably later. But you see the difficulty here with the chronology and the genealogies is that the same names recur over and over again. And so it's sometimes hard to figure out when two people are mentioned just by their first name in two different sources. You have to try to figure out which one they're talking about. And you can even see just glancing down the list of the priesthood that the same names recur over and over again. And the fact that we put numbers after them, that's our convenience. You know, they weren't going by I'm Onias II, you know, they would just say I'm Onias. The same thing with the Ptolemy and Seleucid rulers that we went through when we put numbers after them. At any rate, that brings us up to the end of the record of the Old Testament, even though we've diverged a little bit because the chronology isn't quite the same here. But now from there down to the Maccabean period is what's covered on the rest of the table there. So we have here now a son of Jaddua named Onias, and you can see him on the table there. And then we have the next person is Simon. He was the son of Onias. Now Josephus calls him Simon the Just. So Simon the Just is a celebrated priest that's celebrated in one of the apocryphal books, Ecclesiasticus. So some of you probably heard of that book. There's a bunch of chapters in Ecclesiasticus that celebrate famous men and sort of give a poetic celebration of some of the famous men, most of them from the Bible. But this Simon is one of the ones who's celebrated in chapter 50. And Josephus calls him the Just. And so we don't know exactly who this person is. There's confusion here again about which Simon is in view here. Josephus identifies this guy as the one that's being celebrated in Ecclesiasticus. The description, though, in the book just says that he's a son of Onias, which fits both this Simon as well as the one about five down there, Simon the Second, who's also a son of Onias. But this priest is celebrated. It's sort of an idealistic celebration of him, you know, of all the wonderful things that he's done. I didn't bring my Ecclesiasticus book, or I could read you a few passages from there. But he lauds his building projects also, which could fit, again, in either time period. So it's hard to identify exactly which one this is. You can see then after this, we start to diverge. There's all these bars going around people. That's my attempt to show the family relationships as well as the succession. So Eleazar was the next high priest, and he was a brother of Simon because Simon's son Onias was too young at that point in time. That would be Onias the Second. You can see he comes back in a few down there. He positively identifies Eleazar as during the reign of Ptolemy the Second, so we know exactly when that was. You can see there on the dates. And that's important because Eleazar then is the priest who is mentioned as being in Jerusalem during the translation of the Septuagint. Remember, the Septuagint was the translation of the Old Testament that was carried out in Alexandria. Actually, Pastor had to refer to the Septuagint last week during his sermon because of the translation there from Hebrews. But the Septuagint was done at this period of time, and so this Eleazar is the priest who's mentioned as the one who was involved in that translation, sending the scholars to Alexandria. We'll tell that story later when we get to the Septuagint in a few weeks. But after that, so then we have Manassas, or Manasseh, who was, again, another relation. He was an uncle of Eleazar, and I think all of these people were priests just because Onias was not old enough at that point. But after Manassas, Onias the Second took over as the high priest, and he was the son of Simon. And again, Josephus puts him right in the reign of Ptolemy the Third, so we can date that exactly there. You know, I've got circa 230 there, B.C. Now, Josephus tells an interesting story about Onias the Second. He apparently was a lover of money, is the way he describes him, and he wouldn't pay his taxes to Ptolemy. So this is the world power at the time over Palestine, the Ptolemy ruler in Egypt. And Onias decided he wasn't going to pay taxes anymore, so he angered Ptolemy, and Ptolemy was getting ready to come and invade again and force them to pay the taxes. But Onias had a nephew by the name of Joseph, and Joseph realized the danger that they were in, and he went and collected all the money. He collected a bunch of money, and he went and paid it to Ptolemy. Now, it wasn't enough. You know, there's a big, long story about it, but he won his favor, basically. He got into the Ptolemy's graces and was made a head tax collector with authority to go back to Israel and compel people to pay their taxes. And there's some stories about people resisting and him killing everyone in the town because they wouldn't pay their taxes. I think that happened twice, and then everyone after that paid their taxes. Anyways, it's an interesting story. It gives us insight into the tax collection process and how people had authority from the king to come back and collect taxes to take back. And the highest bidder got to be the tax collector. So that gives you insight into what was happening in the New Testament and why tax collectors were so looked down upon. Number one, because they were doing it for the foreign government. So that's one thing. But the second thing is they were putting money into their pockets. So they would bid to get that office because they knew it was going to be lucrative for them. And so you see, this is a good example of that, where he bid a lot of money, money that he didn't even have, to get the ability to collect taxes because he knew that he was going to be able to get the money back. And so that, again, just all these things give you a little bit of insight into some of the things we read about sort of cursorily in the New Testament. It's kind of just assumed that you know about tax collectors in the New Testament. So that was Onias. Then he had a son by the name of Simon. Now Josephus places him during the reign of Seleucus, which you can see there. You remember him. He was the son of Antiochus the Great. Others believe that he was actually in office during the time of Antiochus the Great, and that this, in fact, is the priest who is referred to as Simon the Just in Ecclesiasticus. At any rate, Simon had a son by the name of Onias the Third. Now, Onias is the one that we've talked about before. So let's, at this point, we'll rehearse what happened with Onias and the two other guys after him. So before I do that, are there any questions or comments about the priesthood or anything up till now? I know it's just pretty much just a long, tedious line of people at this point. Yeah, John. The question is, what was the political and cultural alliance of the high priests? Were they interested in Hellenization? So there's still the Zadokite line, and they're basically holding true to the Jewish religion, and they're resisting Hellenization. One of the things we haven't talked about yet, which I kind of have, I think, in the summary, but it might be good to mention now, is that in the absence of any local king, so remember, they're being ruled by Egyptians or later Syrian rulers. They're not Israelites, and there's no local king. There's not even a local authority like we find in the New Testament under Roman rule. That's pretty much absent. They're being ruled by the king, you know, the Egyptian king at this point. And just switching over here to the Antiochus, which is the Syrian king. So the high priest was viewed basically as the local ruler. He was the local authority. So they had a lot of power over the local population, a lot of influence. And so they were not only the priests, they were sort of de facto, they were the local political ruler as well. And so, you know, that was the relationship that they had with the ruler at the time. So under Ptolemy II, for instance, with Eleazar, they had a pretty good relationship. So Ptolemy wanted to translate the Old Testament, and Eleazar, the story goes, sent a bunch of scholars to Alexandria to help with that translation. So they were on relatively good terms. Most of these were on relatively good terms with the Ptolemies. We mentioned before that the Ptolemies were, although they were Hellenizing, it was more of a voluntary Hellenizing. They weren't forcing the Jews to give up their religion. They weren't forcing the high priest out of office or anything like that. So they had a pretty good relationship with the Ptolemy rulers, which changes right where we are here with Onias III. So in general, they were holding true to the biblical religion and resisting any Hellenization, even though that was sort of in the culture a little bit. Any? The question is, did they have civic duties as well for the king? They weren't placed in an authoritative position by the king. So they weren't like a governor, like what we would see in the New Testament under the Romans or even with the Herods. You know, they were governors. They weren't official that way, but they were sort of... Right. So they just had a lot of sway over the local population and try to stay in good graces with the Egyptian ruler or the Syrian ruler so that they wouldn't come and mess with their religion, basically. Basically, you know, the Israelite government was set up as still as a theocracy. But there's no king now. That's the difference, right, between King David and King Solomon, and the kingship is gone. So the high priest sort of, by default, I think, had to assume a little bit of that civic and political type of authority. Certainly he was viewed that way by the population. Any other questions? Yes, Jen. The question is, does that explain some of the longing that we see in the New Testament for a king? And I think probably what you're referring to is the expectation that the Messiah was going to be a messianic king who would establish his kingdom and kick the Romans out, you know, that type of thing. So there's certainly this sense that things aren't right, which is exactly what we would expect. One of the things that I was thinking about this morning with this is you see the record of all these priests who were imperfect, and you see cases of murder, and it just kind of goes downhill after this. But all of that is setting up for the true high priest that is going to come on the scene shortly. You can say the same thing about the kingship. So here they don't even have a king, but they're subject to a foreign rule. And you certainly see that in the New Testament with the oppression of the Romans and this sense that this isn't right, you know, we should have our own king. And then the messianic expectations then are even heightened, you know, that the Messiah is going to come and he's going to cast off the yoke of the Romans and establish his kingdom. So there's two things there, right? The king is absent, there is no king, and they're under the oppression of a foreign ruler. We haven't talked about this yet. We'll get to it under literature, but the rise of apocalyptic literature, the rise of messianic expectations. We see that sort of the Qumran community was trying to look for that Messiah to come. So, that's a good point. It's all interrelated. It's just a general sense that hopefully you're getting that sense here when we're going through this, that things aren't right. But this is all setting up for the right time for the coming of the Messiah. Yes, Daniel. Yeah, I think so. I think it's a different longing. I think back then, they wanted to be like the other nations. It's sort of ironic, right? At this point, they've reaped what they sowed in terms of disobedience to God all along the way. First in asking for a king, and then all the idolatry that happened, and then finally the destruction of the temple was a temporal punishment of that in the exile. But now they're back, and now they're under the overlords of other nations, and pretty soon, you know, we're just getting here to the severe persecution that they're going to undergo. And all of this is because of disobedience, ultimately. And if you read Maccabees, 1st or 2nd Maccabees are both written from the perspective of sort of an Orthodox person who wanted to retain the Jewish religion. And they say throughout the books of Maccabees that this was all a result of our disobedience. So it has that perspective to it. Any other questions? Okay. Well, let's pick up here at Onias III. This is where everything fell apart with the Syrian rulers. So we covered this before, but I'll just run through it briefly again to remind us here in the context of the priesthood. Onias III, you remember, was deposed and replaced by his brother Joshua, who's better known as Jason, by the way, a Greek name. And you remember the story there. Joshua went, and I'll just call him Jason. Jason went to Antiochus IV and bribed him and offered to cooperate in Hellenization in Jerusalem. His bribe was accepted. Onias III was deposed from office, and Jason took over the high priesthood. And you remember he built a gymnasium in Jerusalem. But then a rival by the name of Menelaus went to Antiochus and offered him more money. Then Jason was deposed, and Menelaus took over. Now the difference here, well, first of all, we have a Hellenizer coming in and bribing and getting his brother deposed. So that's one big problem, right? The second big problem is when Menelaus did this, most people believe he wasn't even from the priestly line. If you piece together a couple passages from 2 Maccabees, it appears that he was likely from the tribe of Benjamin and not even a Levite. So now you can see a further step away from the line of the priests. Now Menelaus, actually had Onias III. So Onias III is still around. He's just deposed. But Menelaus had him executed or murdered in 170 BC. And then Menelaus himself was later executed too. So he lived by the sword and died by the sword. But he was executed under Antiochus V at a later time. So now the Hellenizers have taken over the priesthood. You've got Jason first, and then you've got Menelaus. Now, Jason is still around too, and he became important in the revolt, as you remember from before. But then there's another man by the name of Alcimus. He's a little bit of a mysterious figure to me. Menelaus was removed from office eventually in 161 BC, and Alcimus was appointed high priest at that point in time. He was actually from the Aaronic line. So he was from the priestly family. And so he was kind of welcomed by the Jewish population. But he turned out to be a Hellenizer and became an enemy of the pious Jews and a friend of the Seleucid rulers. So he did a little bit of a bait and switch, I think. He won people over and then turned out to be sort of a tyrant. And there's records of him killing some of the pious Jews at the time. Now, he died after only 2 years, leaving the high priesthood vacant. And as far as we can tell from what Josephus tells us, the high priesthood after the death of Alcimus was left vacant for 7 years until the Maccabean family took over the priesthood in 152 BC. So there's some confusion again here. You can probably see the theme here with chronological confusion within Josephus. But there's some disagreement on who Menelaus was. Second Maccabees and Josephus disagree on his identity. I mentioned some of these things because if you pick up a secondary source, like if you're reading a book on the intertestamental period, they'll often only present one version. They'll present either Josephus' version or the Second Maccabees version, and they often won't tell you that there's a question here about what happened. And you kind of have to read a couple different things in order to realize that there is a problem here. Or if you happen to read both of the original sources, you can see it, but that's kind of hard to do sometimes. So just bringing that up because there's a lot of confusion in the chronology here. Also within Jason and Menelaus later, within Josephus, there's some confusion in his chronology there. Then finally, on your outline here, I mentioned this other guy, Onias IV. He was a son of Onias III. So he's the rightful high priest at this point in time, but he never became the high priest. What happened to him is when Alcimus was sort of appointed by the Seleucid ruler as the high priest after the Jason and Menelaus problems, Onias IV, who is the rightful high priest at this point, the son of Onias III, he realized that the priesthood is never going to come back to our family. So he fled to Egypt. So this again shows you that there was still a very strong pro-Egyptian faction in Jerusalem at this time that was resisting the Seleucid rule. And this was a factor in the revolt. But he fled to Egypt. That shows you that their family was still on good terms with the Egyptian rulers, even though the Egyptian rulers had lost control of Jerusalem and Judea at this point to the Syrians or the Seleucids. But he was welcomed by the Egyptian ruler. At this time, it was Ptolemy VI. And this is very interesting because Ptolemy VI authorized him to construct a temple following the pattern of the temple in Jerusalem at an Egyptian city by the name of Leonopolis and set Onias IV up as the high priest there. So this is a significant event because now there's a rival Jewish temple. There's already a rival Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim, but now there's a rival Jewish temple in Egypt. And the very interesting thing is that the high priest at that temple is actually the legitimate high priest. It also shows you, by the way, that the setting up of a Jewish temple in Egypt at this time shows you that there was a significant population of Jews in Egypt at that time to be able to even justify doing something like that. We mentioned before that in Alexandria, something like 2/5 of the population, certainly 2 of the 5 divisions of the city, were Jewish sections. So we know there was a strong Jewish population in Alexandria. But this testifies to the fact that there was still a large contingency of Jews in Egypt. And as a matter of fact, there were Jewish soldiers that fought in the Egyptian army and served in Ptolemy's army, by the way, as well. So you see pretty good terms between the Jews and the Ptolemy dynasty at this point in time. Well, this temple was set up and it was operated pretty much from this time all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. So after the temple was destroyed in Jerusalem finally in AD 70, only something like 4 years after it had been completed, or maybe even 2 years after it had been finally completed, this temple also was still in operation in Egypt, and it seems to have ceased about the same time. Now, although it maintained the Zadokite line of priests, the priestly heritage, it was generally viewed as schismatic, and the temple in Jerusalem still retained the primary place among the Jews, as you might expect. There's some interesting records and letters back and forth between Egyptians and people in Israel at the time that shed some light on that, that a lot of the money that was given even in Egypt still went to the temple in Jerusalem. The temple in Jerusalem was still recognized as the primary place of worship. So that's just an interesting note. I was never aware that there was a rival temple set up in Egypt until I studied this. So at this point, though, we have a 7-year gap now where there's no high priest ministering. At least that's what most scholars believe. And so that kind of brings us to the summary, and we're out of time, so maybe I'll go through these really fast here, and then we can pick up here next time. So in summary here, the biblical record presents a picture of continued compromise. Desecration of the priesthood is what Nehemiah calls it. And then we talked about how in the absence of the local kings, the high priest really became a national political figure as well as a religious leader. And what we see is a general portrayal of secularization happening here. No doubt there was still a presence of those who were zealous to maintain the purity of the priesthood as well as the purity of Jewish religion. But when the Hellenists took over, it really took a turn for the worse and became a secularized office, really, where secularization was the rule of the day. They were going to bring in the Greek culture, even into the religious worship. And then the overthrow of the Zadokite line by these Hellenists, combined with the persecution, the Antiochian persecution, really set the stage for the next major historical event, which is the Maccabean Revolt. And that's where we're going to pick up next time. We'll pick up at the Maccabean Revolt and go through that.